This is Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're talking about how refugees in Utah contribute to the local economy and to the entrepreneurial ecosystem. Refugees are people admitted to the United States for humanitarian reasons. They arrive escaping political, ethnic, or religious persecution. Once they arrive, refugees tend to move fairly quickly into our workforce. Their efforts to assimilate and contribute help our economy as they work to provide better lives for their families. What's more, some of these refugees go on to innovate and actually start some of their own businesses. And that's what we're talking about today. We are joined today by Aidan Bitar. He is the Director of Immigration and Refugee Resettlement with Catholic Community Services. We also have Natalie Alderi. She is the Deputy Director of Development and Strategic Initiatives with the International Rescue Committee, including the nationally recognized Spice Kitchen Incubator, which is a food entrepreneurship program that helps refugees and immigrants prepare to start their own businesses. Thank you both for joining us today on The Bottom Line.
Thanks for having us.
So let's start with the refugee situation. Give us a rough feel of how many refugees are here in Salt Lake now and maybe statewide, as well as how many arrive each year roughly.
So in the state of Utah, every year between Catholic Community Services and International Rescue Committee, we bring about 1,200 refugees. Over the years, since the refugee resettlement program started in our state, we have resettled close to 60,000 refugees that call Utah their home. And throughout the country, every year, the United States, except historically, the numbers have been up and down, but last year we resettled over 86,000 refugees. This year we were expecting to resettle 110,000 refugees, but unfortunately, with the executive orders, we were not going to achieve that number. However, the numbers of the refugees worldwide have not been slowing down. We have over 60 million people that have been forcibly displaced by wars and political unrest and other inhumane conditions. Of those, 20 million refugees are in the refugee camps that need our protection.
So tell us again, how many per year are coming into the state of Utah?
1,200.
Okay. So relatively a small number. How does that compare historically, maybe like 10 years ago? What was that number?
Well, I think historically, when we started the program 40 years ago during the fall of Saigon, we used to resettle, I would say, double the number where we're resettling now. Those old days, we had a large number, hundreds of thousands of refugees were coming into the United States. But historically in Utah, since that time, the numbers went down. So our agencies, we used to resettle roughly around 1,000 per year. But then recently, the last 2 years, we increased the number. Well, the last couple of years, I would say, we increased the number to 1,200, which I think it's not, between our two agencies. We always have to look our community, and this is in consultation for all our stakeholders in our community, and this is what we do as Utah and all of us together, looking at our resources. Employment is one of the biggest key factor, and also housing, and so we look all those factors in order for us to bring refugees, that we have all the resources that we needed.
Okay. And Natalie, let me ask you, your title is you're the Deputy Director of Development and Strategic Initiatives, and your company is the International Rescue Committee. Mm-hmm. What does the International Rescue Committee do?
So we are a humanitarian aid organization. We work all over the world and throughout the United States as a resettlement agency. Here, we, similar to Catholic Community Service, we meet families at the airport and provide all the services that they need from their first time of arrival up to 2 years, just for their case management. The two-year case management program is something that's unique to Utah. We are the only state that provides that long, extensive, and extended case management to ensure that families reach self-sufficiency upon their arrival. Typically, in other states, refugees would only receive 3 to 6 months of assistance from the time that they arrive, which is very short when you think of somebody who is coming with very little, limited English, myriad of literacy and educational skills, and for them to be self-sufficient in that time period is an uphill battle. And so we're lucky in Utah that we're able to provide that extended case management service.
And what do we have, or who do we have to thank for the fact that we do provide 2 years of services versus 3 to 6 months?
Sure. We have the state of Utah is a very welcoming state to refugees. We are, again, nationally recognized across many, and internationally as well, in terms of the types of services that we provide to refugees and how wraparound we have become. We have lots of highly recognized programming that does that, but the state of Utah has been able to allocate and to advocate for us to be able to support refugees for those 2 years. And then beyond, both of our organizations have citizenship classes, and the IRC specializes in entrepreneurship as well.
Okay. I wanted to add that, you know, Utah has been doing really great when it comes to integrating refugees into our community successfully, because we all do wonderful services to the refugees. And I would like to give a huge credit to our governor, who stood up, and especially when many other states were saying they're not going to resettle Syrian refugees, our governor stood up and said, you know, we will welcome in Utah Syrian refugees. And I would like to acknowledge that. And also our legislators have been really helpful as well and very supportive, and our state agencies are very supportive, and both our organizations, Catholic Community Services and International Rescue Committee, and also the LDS Church also provides a lot of resources to the programs and the services that we provide as well. That made it possible for all of us, all these wonderful services that we provide.
Yeah, you know, I heard about the governor making that statement, and I applaud, as I'm sure as you just gave him a kudo for doing so. I think a lot of us applaud him for doing that. You know, the concern, the issue there on a national level is, gee, maybe we're accepting people that we shouldn't be accepting. And how do we screen them? Let's talk about that just briefly for a second. Is that a legitimate concern, or is that something that we really don't see those connections?
I think, yes, that's a legitimate concern. Our community should be concerned. But I think, we need to also to look at the program, the refugee resettlement program that the United States administer. When we started the program 40 years ago, to date, more than 3 million refugees were resettled in the United States, and no single refugee ever was charged a terrorism link. And this is a very, very safe program. Refugees have to go through a very rigorous screening process, that they have to be fingerprinted, their names will be checked, and multiple agencies in the intelligence community do that process. And they all testified, said that the refugee program is a very safe program, and there shouldn't be any worry about, or there shouldn't be any fear, as I think the fear has been exaggerated. And our community here locally in Utah, you know, we resettled more than 60,000 refugees, and no link to any of those ever was linked
to the same is true nationwide. There has not been a link to any of the refugees to a terrorist event.
The Cato Institute put out a study last year that stated that your chances of being killed by a refugee are 1 in 3.64 billion. That's a pretty alarming and drastic statement, correct, in terms of the fear that's being perpetuated in the media versus the reality of what that is. And so I think that's very telling in and of itself. The other thing, too, is that that Governor Herbert sent a team from the Public Safety Department here in Utah to Washington to understand in depth what the security and vetting process is. And he himself stated that there's really nothing else that they could do. They are doing an excellent job the way that it is.
I'm glad to hear that. Now, what about, so the refugees come here getting a job is a really important first step to assimilating and building a successful life here. What about the tangential effects of this fear that the country currently has? Is it getting harder for refugees to find jobs? Have you seen that trickle down to other areas?
I don't know that we've seen it trickle down in terms of employment specifically. We have seen it in larger community fear and distrust among government officials and public safety, as well as in schools. We have seen and heard of incidents where there is increased incidence of bullying and kind of discrimination for a person's religious background or being a refugee in and of itself. And so both of our organizations work very strongly and closely with the school districts to do quite a bit of education. Granite School District specifically has increased their education around refugee students that all teachers are required to participate in some cultural orientation and cultural sensitivity classes to ensure that their educators are having the correct information and can mitigate some of those challenges in the classroom.
Okay.
Yeah, I think one important aspect also, refugees, when they arrive, within 6 months, they've been here in Utah. Majority of them get a job to provide to their families. They do not want to live on handouts. And that's why we always emphasize self-sufficiency is the key to integrating refugees into our community. But I think it is important that because we have so many employers that are willing to hire refugees when they see the hard work that the refugees provide. And Utah has been also known the most welcoming state in the United States. But ever since that, this rhetoric the last couple of months that have been going on, I think that puts the refugees in very difficult circumstances. You know, the children have been bullied in schools, and people were told to go back to your home country. And I think that is not who we are as an American, and also not who we are as Utah. So I think we should be welcoming the refugees. We should show them love and respect, the same love that we would like we would want in case we've been into their shoes.
Yeah, completely agree. And it's going on throughout the country. There's no safe havens right now. I live up in Park City, and there's been some incidents of bullying and go back to your country type statements, and it's just really sad. And I think Park City is a very welcoming community. So if it's happening there, it's happening in greater focus, greater intensity other places. Let's talk about the job situation. I had mentioned in the green room before we started the interview, I had a nanny a decade ago who was the daughter of a refugee. She came over as a young child as well. Her mother was a judge in Colombia. Unfortunately, she got kidnapped, was held by the kidnappers for over a year, so it was a very horrible situation. Very intelligent woman, a judge, so obviously she was an attorney and then moved up to a judge in Colombia. And she ended up in Park City actually cleaning rooms in hotels. And in the research that our producer Ross Chambliss puts together for these interviews, I noticed that one of the big employers is Grand America and Little America Hotels. Talk to us about the type of jobs that refugees typically get.
So refugees, when they first arrive, both agencies and also another agency called Asian Association, we emphasize employment from day one of the refugees' arrival, and refugees are eager to accept whatever job that is offered to them so they can provide to their families. So, hospitality industry is one of the biggest employers in our community, the hotels, and also there's a lot of jobs in the manufacturing and production and retail industry and meat plants, and the airport also hires the majority of our refugees. And refugees also open businesses, and I'm sure Natalie will talk about some of the businesses that they have been working with. And so any job that is offered to the refugees, I have not seen any refugee turning it down, so they would accept whatever job that is offered to them.
I think it also helps that Utah has a low unemployment rate, and so there is opportunity there for people to get jobs rather quickly as opposed to some of the other states in our nation. But I would echo Batar or Aiden's sentiments in terms of how eager people are to work despite their education levels. We have a lot of people who come here with higher advanced degrees, similar to the woman that you're speaking of, who are engineers, have worked with the U.S. military overseas, and have very, very high advanced education levels that do want to provide for their families and will take a job in food industry just to make ends meet for the time being. with always the hope that they'll be able to go back to school or to start a business or to do something that would advance their families later on.
I think we all have stories where, you know, maybe somebody was our Uber driver that was a refugee and was an engineer or a PhD in their other country, and now they're having a hard time getting a job doing the field that they're experts in. Why is it so challenging for somebody that's an engineer in a foreign country when they become a refugee here? Why is it so difficult to get a similar job here?
I think the biggest challenge is that I think there's a language barrier, and also our educational system may not be comparable with other countries. So I think there is a recertification is required. Many of the professionals, when they get here, I was an attorney in my home country when I left Somalia, and I came here. I have to start all over to get, you know, back to the legal field, and it took me many education and many certifications that I have to go through. But at the same time, refugees, as Natalie mentioned, you know, they have to start somewhere while they're working toward, you know, getting their goal. And many of the Iraqis and Syrians that we're getting now, they have highly professional skills that are coming with. So University of Utah, for example, has a really a good program that they can help any individual with a high degree to go back to their field of professional.
I think one additional point to add is in many cases, people have fled without any documentation of their degrees or their educational background or transcripts or those types of things. And when you're thinking about going back to a war-torn country to ask a university to send the transcripts, that's not quite at the highest of their priorities. And so it's very difficult to even prove that you have that educational background.
All right. If you're just joining us this morning, we're discussing refugees and the positive impact that they make on our local economy as well as the entrepreneurial ecosystem. Our guests today are Aidan Batar. He is the Director of Immigration and Refugee Resettlement with Catholic Community Services. We also have joining us today Natalie Alderi. She is the Deputy Director of Development and Strategic Initiatives with the International Rescue Committee. So we're talking about jobs. We're talking about the entry-level jobs that folks typically have to take when they first come. Some of them have professional degrees. Some can climb back up the ladder to get to that. Others choose different lines of work. And Natalie, I know your group is helping people that want to be entrepreneurs. There's an incubator. It's called the Spice Incubator. Tell us about that.
Sure. The Spice Kitchen Incubator is a program that was started in 2013 in partnership with Salt Lake County. Spice starts for supporting the pursuit of innovative culinary entrepreneurs, which I think that says a lot in and of itself of the work that we're trying to do. We received a lot of inquiries from the community of people who wanted to start food businesses. Many people owned or worked in food businesses in their home countries or in the second country that they migrated to, and so it was something that was familiar to them, and they wanted a way to be able to translate those skills into starting their own business here and learning about the U.S. food industry. So we started the program, modeled it after a program in San Francisco called La Cocina. That's an excellent program, and they provided some technical assistance to us to get it started.
So take us inside the tent. What does that incubator program look like for the attendees?
Sure. So we have a pretty rigorous application process. We want to make sure that people have a viable product, that they know how to cook in and of itself. And once they enter the program, they go into a phase called pre-incubation, and that's where we're just focused on business planning with them and product development. And so from there, after about 6 months, they walk out with a business plan and apply for their business license, get their insurance, and then they move into our incubation program. We have a 4,000 square foot space that includes a large commercial kitchen. And so we offer for people who are in the incubation phase low entry rates for the commercial kitchen. That's one of the largest barriers, is that accessing affordable commercial kitchen space is really difficult. It's very expensive to rent commissary space in the city. And so to even try out your business, it's pretty high risk. And so we offer that at a pretty minimal rate for the entrepreneurs in the program. And from there, we start to help them access market opportunities through catering, through downtown farmers markets. We have a few people who are starting food trucks this summer. And we have one couple who started a brick and mortar restaurant. restaurant that's just across from Pioneer Square. It's called La Na Thai. And so we've had some pretty good success, and it's been really great to see these entrepreneurs flourish and really find their footing in our community and really be proud of their food and who they are.
So let's talk about a couple of those. So a food truck, that's fairly expensive. I think the fully outfitted truck is probably $50,000.
Mm-hmm.
Does the program have trucks that the entrepreneurs utilize for the first couple months, or how do they cross that barrier to the $50,000 asset they need to get going?
Sure. We have quite a few financial products that we're able to help refugees with, starting with a credit building loan. And so we would help them access a certain amount of funding that we then report that they pay back and they report to their creditors. And so we start to build their credit. That's kind of the first step. So we're looking at their whole financial background and where they'll be able to access capital down the road. And then the second thing that we have is a microloan fund that we can loan up to $10,000 to an individual. So that helps with some of the barrier to entry in terms of getting those startup funds for something like a food truck. And then we really are looking around the community, trying to help them find the best deal possible for a used food truck and used equipment and things that they can not necessarily have the latest and greatest and most fancy food truck, but something that will get them started. We really believe in entrepreneurs having skin in the game, and so many of them have been saving for a couple of years to be able to afford something like that.
Is the experience, and this is a question for both of you guys, is the experience for a refugee for getting a loan similar to what it would be for a U.S.-born citizen, or is it dramatically different?
It's quite a bit different. Our lending system in the United States is very different than what a lot of the refugees who come to the U.S. are accustomed to, which is why the IRC started our microloan program. Our loans are very much character-driven, and so a lot of people don't have the financial background or assets that you would need to be able to go to a regular financial institution and say you need a loan for a food truck. It's just not going to work. They're not going to get approved. And so that's why with our microloan program, we're able to provide that entry level, help them build that history, that financial history, and have a solid business plan to then, within the next 2 to 3 years, be able to go. Their next step is to access mainstream financial services or loan or lending programs. We have had some success with individuals purchasing homes through our programs. And again, the three kind of major indicators that we have for refugees in our financial programming is whether they're increasing their income, if they're developing assets, and if they're building their credit. And so those are the three things that we want to see out of anybody that's accessing any of our financial programming, and we're starting to expand that to anyone who's receiving services in the IRC.
I think the refugees, when they first arrive, I think one of the things that we do at the beginning as part of their cultural orientation that they need to know about in the United States is, financial literacy. It's very important that they need to learn that from day one, because as they get jobs and we teach them, and we don't do as an agency, we bring the bankers, to come to our office and teach that from their perspective, and then we open a bank account for them. So they learn that from day one, and then as they try to save and then refer them to these other programs like IRC, that the micro enterprise and others in the community, and we work together, and refugees, in a couple of years, you will see them buying homes and achieving their financial dreams like other Americans, and I think they do really well, but they need that initial support so they can get to their dreams.
Yeah, I have a friend who's an entrepreneur, and for his second or third company, he did a microloan specifically targeting folks that are not fully documented here in the United States, and actually worked with Catholic Community Services, trained to get folks in the public that are interested in helping out to provide some money that the Catholic Community Services would then be involved in helping with this non-traditional credit scoring. The Catholic group would act as kind of the credit screening and say, here's folks that have the character, that have been working hard, that are dependable, and their lives would be changed by a $1,000 loan. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, my friend Wes, his company, he pivoted and is no longer in that space. Are there local organizations that listeners that are listening to this and say, you know, I'd be interested in helping out and helping to provide microloans. Typically, those are crowdfunded. Mm-hmm. People can put in $100, $1,000, and the returns actually have been pretty attractive. And overall, people get their money back, and it's a way to help give back while ultimately, hopefully, getting your money back. Are there any programs here locally that people can participate in?
So with the IRC, we do have a revolving loan fund that people can contribute to that would help provide a myriad of different types of loans to refugees. Locally, we haven't really entered the space as a community into the crowdfunding realm. And one of the primary reasons for that is because a lot of the crowdfunding platforms are very much web-based, right? And so a lot of the entrepreneurs that we're working with just don't have the digital literacy skills to be able to manage and to promote their crowdfunding platform. And so so it's definitely something that we've been talking about as a community, but something that we quite haven't really been able to overcome that idea or reduce that barrier for the digital component. But I mean, we would love to explore that. Certainly, again, we're constantly revisiting it.
And right, if anybody so has any ideas, entrepreneurs yes, out there, I, exactly. I do think it's a great idea. And there's a really good history of having decent returns. So mm-hmm. you can do well as a company, you can do well as an investor while also helping out.
Yeah, and I think one of the other things that is important with this initial loan that the refugees need also. Like, for example, you're getting a family, for example, a job, and transportation is a big barrier for many of the refugees when they get a job. So having them to purchase a car, for example, if they can get a small loan to do that, I think that has been really helpful. I know IRC and us, we've been working together. We're referring some of our clients to get that microloan and has been helping. And I know some of them get that loan and get the Uber or some things that they can provide to their families. I think those things would be really helpful.
Okay. And with the programming like the auto loan program or any of the credit building, it's always, or home buying, it's always coupled with education. We're always doing classes that accompany the loan buying process or the loan, taking out the loan and then whatever purchasing process they're going through, which I think is really unique because a lot of immigrant communities are preyed upon for certain lending programs and we want to make sure that people aren't getting taken advantage of, and we encourage people to go out and to explore their resources, but to really know what it is that they're doing for any consumer, let alone somebody who has some language barriers and other challenges behind them.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more with Aidan Batar. He's with Catholic Community Services, and Natalie Alderi. She is with the International Rescue Committee.
You're listening to The Bottom Line on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're talking about refugees and entrepreneurship in Utah. We have with us Aidan Batar. He is the Director of Immigration and Refugee Resettlement with Catholic Community Services. Also joining us is Natalie Alderi. She is the Deputy Director of Development and Strategic Initiatives with the International Rescue Committee. So we were talking about various programs that can help folks. You know, job number one, when they get here for the first 3 to 6 months, get them a job. And then it's how do they start moving up that employment ladder to better and better opportunities. We talked about the Spice Kitchen. We talked about some microloans. There's also a farming program that the international that Natalie, your group works with. It's called New Roots. Mm-hmm. Is that still going on? And what is that program?
Yeah, it's a great program. It's thriving and continues to grow each year. It was started in 2010, and so we're entering our seventh year here with this next growing season, which is really impressive. We have 30 farmers who work about a 2.5-acre farm and are able to earn around $40,000 collectively in a growing season. When you think about somebody who's earning between $20,000 to $30,000 per year, adding $2,000 to $5,000 into their pocket is pretty significant boost for them. So we're happy to continue to be able to offer that as a supplemental income program for refugees in the community. Now we are expanding our farm and just secured a plot of land with Salt Lake City Corporation that's in the Glendale area, where we will increase our production by another 2 acres so we can move some of the farmers who have advanced skills and are ready to scale up their business onto their own farming land, where they'll be able to just be responsible for what they're doing on that land and make their own sales and such. So we're slowly moving people into their own businesses as part of that. Initially, it's been mostly collective. Each farmer gets a plot, their own plot of land, and we have some very structured resources and training that goes along with that. The other thing that we've been doing with that is Farm to School Initiative, where we are selling a lot of our produce into different school districts, which is very unique for our community as well. And it's been really positive in terms of the school district's response. It's an educational tool for them to share with their student body and their educators where the food is coming from, who's growing the food, and talk about refugee issues in that way. And it's also a very steady income source for the program over the growing season.
Yeah, I can see that being a really nice cycle that just builds lots of positivity around it. Mm-hmm. Aiden, how about from the Catholic Community Services? Once somebody's here 3 to 6 months, They're now working to move up the employment ladder. How does Catholic Community Services help them?
So at Catholic Community Services, we have a employment team that helps the refugees get that first entry-level job. And then after that, once the families have that job and they settle a little bit, then we are looking into upgrading those jobs to see other opportunities for them by providing some additional education and helping them connect with other resources in our community and then moving them up to through the ladder, because it takes some time for the families, because we have to help them improve their language, improve also their employable skills. And our goal is to have everyone to get a job that pays a livable wage. And that's our goal that we have been working into all those families. But we see that, within 6 months first, I would say at least close to 80% of the families that we put in our employment program get jobs. And then after that, we move them up in the ladder. And that has been really, a little challenge, because we don't have a lot of employers. We always go back to the current employers that we have that, are very friendly with refugees. So we need more employers to help employ refugees. And I know once they start with one refugee, they keep wanting them for more. Like, for example, the meat plant in Logan, for example, in Hiram, they have reached to us, our organizations here, and they said, they wanted to hire more refugees. So we took some refugees, and they have over 100 refugees working there right now, and they love them.
Yeah, I would, having dependable employees at the lower end of the wage scale can be challenging. And I think one of the nice things about refugees, I would imagine, is there's not many days they call in sick. They're very dependable because this job means so much to them.
Absolutely. They have a high work ethics, and any company that hires refugees, will help them with their turnout. And also, they don't have to worry, because it's so hard and so expensive to replace someone. But when they hire refugees, the employers can save a lot of money.
So we mentioned hospitality. We mentioned meatpacking. We mentioned the airport. Give us some ideas of other employers, just so if there's people that are listening that may not be thinking their business would be a match, maybe it'll trigger somebody thinking, gee, I could help out as well.
Food industry is always a great one. Manufacturing, Aiden did mention that as, assembly line work or those types of things. There's a lot of warehousing that's on the west side of Salt Lake City that could definitely be an opportunity. I will make one caveat to that transportation to that side of the city is a little bit more difficult for people who don't have their own vehicle. So working with UTA or some other entities who could increase some transportation to that side of the city would be critical. And any business owners who are willing to kind of step up and to be a voice there would be great. And then in addition to that, there's opportunities to move people into their career development, right? So they're getting these entry-level positions in more service industry type sectors. But then what happens after that? How are people achieving upward mobility if they're staying in that chosen sector? And so in addition to the new sectors that we might be able to explore, working with current and future employers to figure out what resources or tools they might be able to provide to help boost someone's English or help help learn new customer service skills or help learn some digital tools that might improve their efficiency and be able to move them into a higher level managerial positions within whatever sector they're at, I think is really critical. And that's definitely a gap that we've seen in the community. It's really, it's been, you know, a little bit more fluid for us to get people into that entry level position, but we don't want to see people stay there like anyone. We want to see them move up.
Yeah, so this might be an ignorant question, but I suspect there's lots of people in our audience that are wondering this as well. So I'm gonna ask it. Why is it so challenging for refugees to learn our language? And because it seems like that's so core to being able to move up in the career progression. And Aiden, you grew up in Somalia. You obviously have a good command of the English language. What, for instance, my nanny's mother still does, you know, 20, 30 years later, still doesn't speak English well. What's the challenge there?
I think the challenge is that, you know, education is the key, and we know many of the refugees that we're bringing, they have been sitting in refugee camps for many, many years where education was not a priority and survival was the priority for them to live and provide to their families. And not discounting when refugees come here, you know, our agencies, we heavily emphasize English and we enroll them into programs. We connect them with volunteers from our community and teaching them English. And some will learn right away and will move up, and some it will take them difficulty to because you know, they haven't had any formal education. It really takes time for them to go, and but they're eager and willing to learn because they all have to become U.S. citizen, and we have also teach citizenship program where they have to learn not only English, but they also have to learn the civics. So we teach them the U.S. history and so forth, where after 5 years, you should see that, you know, I have not seen a refugee not wanting to get their citizenship. They all want, eager to get that, and they learn from day one, and they pass that citizenship. And I know that many of the U.S. citizen, if they look to that citizenship test, is quite difficult.
Is there something you either of you wish that we had access to that would make it easier to get over this language barrier?
I think we don't invest heavily into our ESL programs that we have. So if we could put more resources toward the English ESL programs in our community, I think it would have make much easier. So there are thousands of people that can benefit from that, not only refugees, but also immigrants or anyone who English is not their first language can benefit from that as well. But there isn't enough resources available.
I would agree with that. I think especially when you think of somebody who's getting their first job, working 8 to 10 hours a day, and then having to go to ESL classes after that, yet still have a family at home, it's a difficult thing to juggle for sure. And that's where I was going with the employer base. Like, if you could carve out over a lunch hour to have an ESL instructor come in to offer some of those additional language acquisition resources, then we're kind of coupling it and reducing that barrier a little bit as well. There are a lot of people who are isolated in their homes, and women with children who necessarily can't go to an ESL class because they have to care for their children. And so the IRC is starting to place in-home tutors with some of these people so that they can get ESL instruction in their home while their kids are playing. So looking at, you know, creative ways to reduce some of those barriers, while classroom instruction and formal ESL education is really important, the first step is becoming conversational. And so we want to make sure that people are getting at least to that point, able to pass their citizenship exam and then move ahead. And I think one thing to point out, too, is a lot of people are conversational, can read and write. But when you're thinking about industry-specific language skills, that's something totally different. If you're thinking about manufacturing and learning all the names of the equipment that you're using or different terms or commands to start and stop things, that's a different game than it is, you know, if you're just trying to get around the community and converse with your neighbor.
Okay. One best practice that I could mention that is really working well is that the Humanitarian Center at the LDS Church, and we work collectively, all of our organizations, you know, every year we place about 100 refugees at the Humanitarian Center. So they learn 4 hours English at the work. and 4 hours they learn skills, they work. And that way, you know, at the end of the day, they're getting 8 hours of skill training and also the English, and then they can stay there for up to a year. So after a year, those refugees that are in that humanitarian center, they can move up quickly to a better paying job. They already have the skills. They already have the language. I think that's what we are looking into, some employers, if they could do similar thing. We're not asking 4 hour English, but at least 1 hour, 2 hour, whatever they could afford. I think that would be really make a difference.
Yeah, I just think of the quality of life, right? If you're in a community and you don't speak the language, it would be, you know, it's limiting professionally, but it also isolates you from your neighborhood, and that's just not, it can't be good for anybody.
Right.
What about our formal education system? So, Aidan, you were an attorney in Somalia. You came here. You went back to school to get the certifications, to get you had to take the Utah bar, obviously. What about the state of Utah? Can refugees attend state universities and get in-state tuition, or what does that situation look like for them?
Yeah, the refugees, they are eligible to get the same educational opportunity like the U.S. citizens will get. As soon as they arrive here in Utah, they can get a state residency tuition that, you know, they don't have to pay as international. But I think language is one of the biggest keys, so they have to learn the English language first. You know, even though I was educated and I spoke English, I still have to go back and improve my English, and it took me about a year to get the professional English level that I needed, a college level, and went back to school, and but still my legal background, and that would not be accepted here. You know, that's what I was told at the beginning, and the universities here told me I have to start all over the legal.
Did that turn out to be the case? I mean, to become a lawyer, need your undergraduate degree, and then you need 3 years of law school.
Well,
technically, you just need to pass the bar, but most people need all of that to get.
I think that's not the case, for refugees when they arrive. Even, you know, somebody who has a medical degree from their country and they arrive here, you know, they still that barrier that they have to go to the universities, their degrees will be evaluated, they might have to take some additional classes and then take the exam. For my case, you know, I did not have the luxury of going back to school for 4 years to start, law school, because I have family. But with the help of Catholic Community Services, I was able to get additional trainings and certification I needed. So I am an immigration attorney by training, which is an easier route and also less expensive. And that's what also we're looking. We have to be creative and looking other ways people can go back to their professional, way of getting what they have to do. So I think those are available for refugees, and that's what we're helping with. There was a doctor that we resettled many, many years ago, and he's been practicing over 30 years in all his life. And then when he came here, you know, he could not take the exam right away. So we had to work with the University of Utah Hospital, where they started him with as a technician to do his whatever he's been doing. And then he was happy for that, because he wanted to provide to his family while he's working, getting his medical degree license.
Awesome. So we talked about some advantages that Utah has. And I would think one of the big ones is 2 years of services where refugees can have help and assistance. Are there any things that make being a refugee in Utah more challenging than most states in the U.S.?
I think in Utah, all I could tell you, you know, we do such a great job in making, because all our community working together, and also you have this many wonderful organizations, including the religious organizations, for example, when the LDS leaders said, you know, go out, reach out to your communities, imagine the level of support the refugees are going to get, that our agencies are going to get. And also every month we have that roundtable discussion where we bring things, and as an organization, all of us, we are problem solving. So I think refugees in Utah in general, there's many, many challenges that they face, language and adapting to the new culture. The children, for example, they start school their age, regardless whether they have, formal education or not. And so I think there's areas where we could improve, like education, the language, we have a huge shortage of affordable housing. I think that's one thing that, we're struggling right now, where the rental market is skyrocketing, and we see that a lot of apartment complexes are being built everywhere in our city, but yet it is not affordable for low-income families or refugees to live in. So I highly recommend, the developers out there, if they could at least help set aside some of those units, the refugees can live in, so then that would be really helpful. And then many employers that can help refugees, I think, it will make easier for the transition, because if we don't invest in the refugees from day one, I think we'll pay a heavy price at the end. I think we're not to that level, but I think we need to step up and help the refugees, because in the end, they're part of our community.
Yeah. Natalie, anything you'd add if you had a magic wand that you'd change here in Utah to make it easier?
I think one piece is that while Salt Lake City and along the Wasatch Front, we are very welcoming overall, we're still a conservative state. And I think that lends itself to some misperceptions and understanding of who refugees are, what the actual security and vetting process looks like for people coming into our state, and what the assets and contributions are of refugees. And if I had a magic wand, I would want, the whole state to really understand and take the time to educate themselves on the facts about refugees and making sure that they understand what's happening on a national scale and how that trickles down to impacting our community more specifically.
Well, hopefully we're playing a small role in our conversation today, and both of your organizations are playing a very big and very important role. So thank you for joining us. Just a chance for you guys to plug if there's volunteer opportunities and people are interested in helping out either organization, how would they reach you?
For the International Rescue Committee, you would go to our website, which is rescue.org/SLC. We have lots of different opportunities and a whole section on how to help.
For Catholic Community Services, the same thing, people can go to our website, ccsutah.org, and we have a menu of volunteer opportunity that people can choose, whichever area that they choose, and that will make a difference in somebody's life. And we have family mentoring, we have refugee foster care children, we have over 90 children that in our care right now that we're looking for mentors, and also many other refugee children that we bring that we're looking mentors to mentor them, and so many other wonderful opportunities that would make a change people's lives.
All right. Well, thank you both for joining us this morning, and more importantly, thank you for your efforts and your full-time job. It's amazing to hear these stories.
Thank you very much for having us.
Our guests this morning have been Aidan Bitar. He is the Director of Immigration and Refugee Resettlement with the Catholic Community Services. We also have Natalie Alderi, who is the Deputy Director of Development and Strategic Initiatives with the International Rescue Committee. Today's show was recorded at KCPW Studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. Thank you, Ross. You can hear our entire conversation on our website, kcpw.org, or the Bottom Line podcast. You can tweet me at Savvy Wells or at KCPW Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.